Just for fun, though I'm not really accustomed to it. I can wax on philosophically about a few things that come to mind. Yeah, there's an inverse relationship between the degree to which we imagine or assert that we know what this meaning, you know, reality is, and good evening. I'm just talking to people on the thing here, so don't mind me. There's an inverse relationship between the habit, let's say, of knowing what experience or reality is, and the vividness with which it appears. I'll elaborate. When we operate through memory and conditioning, which is a form of imagination and presumption, metaphoric association, it gives us a sense of, you know, maybe comfort or orientation. One might say even control. And by dwelling in the habit of knowledge or presumption or certainty, we invariably dull down the curious way in which, let's just refer to it as reality, is actually appearing or occurring to us. Because our sensitivity for being in relationship with what's present is compromised by the overlay of imagination as story or genesis or implication, preference, control dramas, regrets, likes and dislikes, planning, strategizing. Yeah. So if the movement of ordinary mind is part of your, you know, present experience, then by virtue of dwelling in imagination, the outrageous, disorienting profundity of actual experience is, well, it's not seen, it's not felt. To the extent that we can experiment with not knowing what this meaning, our experience or reality is, you might discover without all that much effort that the vividness, the majesty, the ordinariness and non-ordinariness of reality becomes, louder. Yeah. Sensually louder, and the nuance of it takes on a different a patina or texture. And you could say that, you know, all yogas, another gross generalization, which we love to make, play this dance of moving from a presumptive state of mind, which is the assertion of imagination, to the innocent frame of mind or a different quality of availability, sensitivity. Mindfulness attempts to do this by encouraging so-called present awareness. Jay Krishnamurti used the term choiceless awareness. Of course, the yamas and niyamas of Raja Yoga are all designed or in service of cultivating a quality of somatic culture, ethical culture, mental culture that supports greater sensitivity through, you know, nonviolence and non-intervention, and thus support a richer or deeper quality of, you know, being present in or being present with experience. When we are tussling with the disquietudes that distract us, we're living in right imagination. We're living in projection, a fantasy of interpretation and implication that places us as a creature in, you know, some kind of temporal or spatial condition. And so conditions and circumstances therefore become adversarial to us. And that's the well, that's the cost of dwelling in imagination. By shifting or attenuating our attention to what could be referred to as not knowing, the antithesis, if you will, of presumptuous metaphoric assertion, well then, the curious serendipity of actual experience becomes, well, you know, more familiar to us. And the joyfulness and novelty of experience becomes more present as we relax and release ourselves from the momentum of imagination, the momentum of being convinced of what reality has been up till now and what reality is or how it's presenting itself in present experience. So the call it the texture of sentient attention of experiential availability is not consumed with imagination, storytelling, fantasy, justification, defensiveness, craving, aversion. You know, all those things that the Buddhists warn you of. Quite to the contrary, the texture of present attention is not consumed with knowing anything, anticipating anything, fixing or correcting anything. By experimenting with that quality of availability, present availability, without interpretation, without justification, without explanation, then one could say that reality has an opportunity to re-flower, re-blossom, reveal itself to itself without the burden of the filter or the meme of, well, being human or being a creature, being the consequence of birth, being someone or something that, you know, needs to be on the lookout or watch out for present or imagined danger. And the deeper that we go into this, or permit ourselves to go into it, or luck out into it, well, the more distant the certitude of one's individuation, specialization, and duration become. So one might discover that simply resting in availability turns out to be liberation itself. There's no point A or point B, or necessity for, you know, purification, righteous behavior, making amends, committing oneself to a path of recovery. Though those, of course, can be useful, you know, if your mind and behavior and self-identity are full of, you know, clutter or various kinds of afflictive toxicity. And for sure, we're all fucked up. No question about it. But if it turns out that you might reach a point of sufficient ease to reconsider the texture of consciousness, then you might discover what it looks like, what it feels like to rest in availability, not as a means to an end, but as the radiant nature of liberation itself. Present experience is the demonstration of the radiant nature of liberation itself. If we are attenuated to imagination and justification, then we might miss the nuanced cues of the vividness of what reality has to share with us or with itself. So learning how, and then being willing to return to an attenuation of consciousness or sentience, which is capable of resting in present availability, one might discover what that feels like, how that expresses itself. To make claims, you know, biographical or otherwise. Well, it becomes childish and good evening, and absurd. It's like, why reference back to the imagination of creaturehood? Why reference back to the imagination of one's biographical story when resting in and resting as availability wipes that slate clean? Well, thanks for giving your attention to this little chit-chat. A few folks have shown up, so I'm going to redirect my attention to who's in the room. Not that anything will change. Fuck of a lot of rain today, huh? Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it rained.
Hey, I'm not complaining.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't bother me that much.
Yeah, then it just, you know, kind of stopped. Rain can do that.
Who's in the chat? Random people or friends?
I recognize the one person that's in the chat. There were a few viewers. But I don't know who they are. I hope it's a talent scout.
Yeah, you're famous, Ron.
Oh yeah. That's right. This is you know, just to get on a Rupert Spiro web conference costs $25.
Oh, just to call in?
Yeah, just to get on one of his web conferences is $25.
How many people can be on it at once?
I'm sure Rupert could give you an answer to that question. Probably a lot. Yeah. Imagine that, just to get on there.
So does that give you, like, question, like asking privileges? Or?
I'm not sure if you just sit there passively or whether you can Q&A up with the guy. Maybe you can Q&A up with him. Yeah. The 6-day retreat is, I don't know, $1,200, you know, if you're in a shared room.
Yeah, it's not too bad for 6 days, I guess.
Yeah, right. Not too bad. You know, 3 squares. Two talks a day. The rest of the time you get to eat and socialize.
I don't know if I ever listened to him before.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with his shtick.
Yeah.
Anything
that American or German or what?
Rupert?
Yeah.
He's a UK guy, I believe.
Yeah.
He's a ceramics artist.
Really?
Yeah.
Who was his teacher?
Francis Lucille, apparently, was...
I'm familiar, but...
Oh, I thought they were both Saint-Lucien.
No, I don't know if Rupert had any direct encounters with Jean Klein. You know, I mean, I don't know his so-called lineage very well, but I think he was attracted to Francis and, of course, you know, appears to be well-read in all this stuff for some number of years. And now he's, you know, one of the top of the heap persons in the non-duality business. Yep.
Yep.
That would be a drag.
I guess you scared everybody away with Sunday's talk.
Was Sunday scary?
Yeah, you're like, just, you went off on that one rant, like, and everyone comes and does the same shit the same time, every time.
Yeah.
And it's not helping anybody. So they,
yeah.
They figured they can...
Must apply to them. This guy doesn't like us.
Yeah, I can't say that I've not taken anything you said personally.
It's inevitable. It's never intended that way, of course, but it's inevitable. Yeah, because I mean, this is about me, right?
Yeah, reading into everything.
Yeah, so it's like, hey, somebody says something, it's got to, you know, it's got to be about me.
It's in your horoscope.
Yeah. Mine, you mean, or someone else's?
Byron Lambert fell, and they had a birthday horoscope book out, and they were both kind of very applicable.
Jeff's?
Yeah. And that's where he learned L. Ron Hubbard was born on the same
day. Oh, that book? I'm reading that book.
Man, that's not good.
No.
That's evil energy that time of
that's
day.
That's some really serious shit. That's right. Yeah.
I have Barack Obama.
Nice.
My birthday.
Wow. Nice.
That's good though. I don't know.
he's more dangerous than L. Ron Hubbard when you get down to it.
Everyone should watch the new Louis C.K. special.
It's really good.
Oh, yeah? All right, then. Everyone should watch the new Louis C.K. special.
17.
Huh? That's on what channels?
On the Netflix.
Netflix?
You saw it already?
Yeah, that's why I was late.
$3.95 or something?
Huh?
No, it's on Netflix.
Oh, it's free on Netflix? You don't have to pay extra?
We have Netflix.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
I think we do. Yes.
I was laughing.
Oh, good.
Usually,
you're not that.
He's not like my favorite. My sister likes him.
Uh huh.
Like,
but he got you this time.
I got him this time.
Sweet.
I like him. He's thoughtful. He frequently says, "Like, look, we don't know what's happening here. No one knows."
Yeah.
I like any time anybody says that, actually.
There's a there's a trick of the trade, I guess. Subtle. We have come to learn how to interpret present experience through a very curious and to some extent functional superstructure of interpretive habit. Our language, of course, plays a, we could say, significant role in converting what one might refer to as actuality into so-called self-absorbed practicality. And like, you know, the fish in water metaphor, we don't notice that we do this because we've been trained in it since pre-verbal, if not pre-birth, if not preconception, you know, time. So we're the product of a you know, you could say species-wide interpretive predilection, which we refer to as consciousness or my consciousness, sentience or my sentience, you know, my body, my feelings, my thoughts, my beliefs, my superstitions, my entitlements, my, yeah, and we think we might be capable of, you know, some kind of objectivity, or, you know, cultivated thoughtfulness, compassion, you know, intelligence. We actually think we're capable of these kinds of behavioral markers or behavioral accusations, self-accusations. So we, let's say, wander through the life under the influence of this unearned pride of how we feel and come to believe what it is that's true about ourselves, our firsthand experience, and the world at large, depending on how much of that so-called world we're exposed to through media, travel, wealth, socioeconomic class, firsthand experience, shitty, neutral, or great childhoods, etc., etc. Yeah. So what keeps us... well, what keeps us imaginarily incarcerated, though it appears, you know, functionally or unavoidably incarcerated, is this really impersonal movement of interpretive bias reinforced by language and the hot and cold implications of language that also reinforce what we might refer to as my somatic experience, right? Comfortable, uncomfortable, hot, cold, relaxed, not relaxed, sanguine, not sanguine, ecstatic about the future, dreading the future, ecstatic about the past, dreading the past. Right, so our emotional structures and psychiatric structures and our self-identity is the result of this impersonal matrix of associative and interpretive predilection or presumption that locks us into the you know, gross insistences of a million and one superstitions that we don't even know we have. Because we think we're cool, live, you know, unafflicted, atheistic, agnostic, humanistic, democratic, or worse, Republican. We think we are the product of choice as concerns, you know, how we roll. Now, with all of that crud, what's it called? Filling your plumbing, your psychic plumbing, right? Your drain pipes are just way backed up. And so, you know, the shit that you have for a mind doesn't drain well. And this, what this, you could say, this contributes to the frustrations of even the best of spiritual aspirations and practices, and why they inexorably fail so miserably. Because all of these externalizations of practice and purification and behavior and righteousness and repeat, devotion and yogas and, you know, physical culture and emotional culture are all still based on this shit for brains that we are the product of. So we're trying to manage the imagination of the world, or we're trying to manage the imagination of ourselves to feel differently, to feel better, to have peace of mind, to be useful to our fellows. And it's quite possible that none of it's true, that it's all fabricated. But we still insist reflexively on making it work, or making ourselves work, when it won't work. If we don't consider the possibility of becoming sensitive to the inertia and deeply embedded nature of conditioning, then it might be, one could conclude from one's own experience that we remain a product of that conditioning. Just everything seems to be working just swell. People are chatting. Hopefully amongst themselves, because I don't know how to respond to anything.
Are those like stretchy pants? You're just like able to do yoga full jeans, no problem.
Well, no, not full yoga. They are stretchy jeans.
Oh, okay,
but they're not the same as yoga pants.
Yeah, yeah. I was curious. I can't even like wearing jeans. I can't even like squat and touch the ground.
You don't have man stretchy jeans.
No.
All the boys wear stretchy pants now.
Yeah. Man yoga pants. That'll be the day I'm the thing.
Could you imagine that? Who's that piano player?
Liberace.
He's one.
That is the right direction, I guess.
Who's that piano player that's friends with Suzanne? What's her name?
Suzanne.
Your friend from Southern California that still menstruates.
Hey. Jesus Christ.
What? No one knows that?
That is a weird thing to say.
Suzanne Summers, who's in her
60s. Oh, right. Oh yeah.
Yeah, Suzanne Summers.
Suzanne Summers in her 60s takes enough hormones to continue to be a menstruating adult woman.
You just put it off. Barry Manilow.
I was just about to say, weren't you absolutely shocked that Barry Manilow is gay?
I'm too young for this Barry Manilow fellow. Oh, okay. I'm not familiar. He's like,
got to you, really, he's like Frank Sinatra.
Really deep voice. I don't know.
No,
that's Barry White I'm thinking of.
Yes, yeah. No.
Barry Manilow.
Same person at all.
He might be the same person, Barry Manilow. And, yeah. Who would have thunk? He came out as being gay at 70-something years old. No one had any idea. It was such a shock.
Some people might have known. A couple people might have known.
Suzanne Summers knew.
I wonder if at that point if it's too embarrassing to come out and she just pretend to take it to the grave.
Yeah. Yeah, you're better off that way. There's no utility. At some point, you may as well just die with the secret. Where were we? No place special.
I don't know how he came up.
But neither do I.
Man, yoga pants. I'm guessing that was the connection.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Try to trace it back. It's a synaptic mystery. So, the point was, not that there was one, without becoming sufficiently sensitive or curious about the overriding nature of one's conditioning and therefore presumptive habit as concerns dwelling in experience, then the implication of that conditioning is, well, less likely to fall away or less likely to shift.
Wait, what makes it less likely?
If you fail to investigate or see.
Yeah. I guess if you never consider it, sure.
Then your default nature is
doing
what it does.
Yeah.
And you'll never, venture outside it. Yes, so what's the implication of that, if any at all? Thankfully there's none. As concerns the adventure of so-called liberation or awakening. You see, if you're fucking with yourself, which religious and spiritual systems encourage, if you're fucking with yourself through contemplative processes, yogic processes, fire walking, ACIM, JYNs, turning it around, on and on and on and on and on and on ad nauseum, if you're fucking with yourself, how the fuck are you going to find an outlet out from under the influence of this default assertive conditioning? Because you're celebrating it, even if you're unhappy with it. You're celebrating it even if you're happy with it. Anything that you do with yourself or about yourself as concerns your role as a creature in a world is simply going to be understandably reinforcing of the implication of that conditioning.
Pretty much everything I do.
Pretty much everything we all do.
And even if you try to do something about it, just doing more of the same shit.
Yes. Yes. Now this frustration / insight is, it's not that easy to come by.
It does give you at least the rarefied 3-second break filled with laughing, but that's about all I've ever heard.
That's not.
Oh, I'm doing some crazy ass shit again.
Well, I hear you. I mean, don't kick a gift horse in the mouth.
I'm saying it's something.
Yeah, if you get a 3-second giggle relief from the idiocy of yourself, that's as good as Ramana Maharshi got.
I was watching the news. Lots of people do crazy shit, and just thinking like, man, you can just tweak some dials, some input, some shit that's happened in my life, and I could be doing the same crazy shit they're doing.
Sure.
There's really nothing significant about my, stand to do better than them,
No. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, no choice that you've made, you know, separates us from anything or anyone else.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's strange though, I still like actively, well, I guess that's a funny word to use, but still like that sense of like taking ownership of everything. Like me, I'm doing this, my, and it's like,
yeah.
I mean, that's even like from like a strictly like rational, factual point of view, it's like this just doesn't really seem to make any sense, but
no. But
it's still what I do, it's my thing.
Yeah. Right. It occurs.
Yeah, yeah.
It occurs. Yeah. Now, this is curious. That occurs, and that one becomes, you know, aware of it through more through a giggle than unbearable despair. Though unbearable despair is useful too, you know.
There's a lot.
Yeah, that happens a lot too. A giggle is a little more relaxing than unbearable despair, but they both have their utility. As concerns what a self-loathing poser I am on a 24/7 basis. Yeah. Okay, so that established. Here's the challenge of it. Even in the midst of this seemingly unceasing movement of identification and association, self-infatuation, and all of the foolishness that it appears to conjure, you are still, from so-called moment to moment, dare I say, absolutely free of it.
I guess freedom's not really what it's cracked up to be.
Well put. That's right. Yep.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Well, see, this is the heart, if I dare use that word, and I'm not referring to love. The heart of the, let's just say, the thrill of one's capability to consider the miracle of present experience is, what would it feel like to release yourself or be released from the habit of self-interpretation through the familiarity of the language sets and assessment sets that set up the imagination of yourself to begin with. That's
what?
Yeah, I'll come back around to this because it's worth
sets and...
How is it that I continue to feel myself as myself, or relate to this present moment through the inertia of that conditioning? That's what I'm calling into question. Can there be a quality of pause so that one is not messing with present experience through the lens of familiarity, through the lens of language?
Without going insane?
Absolutely without going insane. Well, even
who says?
But going insane can be useful.
Mm.
I mean, yeah, you're going to go. Yeah, I mean, yes, you're going to pass through you're likely to pass through a certain fire that can certainly look and feel like one or several forms of insanity as the habit of acquisition shifts. Yeah. It seems that way.
Functionally easy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems like whenever I come, you say some shit. My mind does its thing, and like it's just, you know, jostling for position, I guess.
Yeah, that's just it. So you see, the jostling for position is an acquisition habit.
Sure. Yeah. And
that, okay.
Eventually, there'll be some sort of, I don't know, like resolution tableau, perhaps you could say, and like that gives way to something, you know, different quality of experience. But every time, it's always like, all right, so don't do exactly what it says. Don't take it literally. Don't try to do the way you did it before. And then it's like just layers upon layers of like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Crazy, like.
Yeah. That's right.
What are you left with then, with all those structures?
Well, I was gonna say, like, you know, eventually it just implodes, perhaps. But I can't really say. You know, I could say like, this was like the thoughts leading up to when it stopped. You know, but every time, like, that doesn't ever really like work. Again.
No,
as a strategy.
Yeah, no, you can't. That's right.
So I can't really say.
Yeah, you can't. That's right. There's no on ramp, or at least no reliable on ramp.
But sometimes it seems to chill out. Like
mm-hmm.
Each time has been like, has had sort of like a different quality. Yeah. Like a different side of things, I guess. But things other people have mentioned, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All equally interesting, I guess.
Sure. I mean, look what's happening. This is a mutation. Make no mistake. Conformist reality and so-called human consciousness is fucked. And to bring the full force of your arousal and affection to the questions of the structure and functioning of your own consciousness, that's a mutation. So one is already engaged, you know, voluntarily or otherwise, in a mutation adventure. And the habit, the kind of the pulsing habit of habitual acquisition strategies that assert who you are, where you are, how you feel, what you think about, is there an on-ramp, is there a repetition, anything at all, right? Any so-called self-reflection at all that places you in a time, in a place, in a mood, in a condition, in a position, in anything, can only be the outguessing of an acquisition strategy. A reflexive, conditioned acquisition strategy. Which is the citadel and building blocks and imagination of self. There's no actual ego. The E-G-O means what exactly? Well, when you have a big ego, it just means, you know, your acquisition strategy and the way that you relate to other people, you could say, draws more attention to yourself in dysfunctional ways than it nourishes the people that you're with. So you're accused of having a big ego. I mean, Tony Robbins has a big ego, but his looks like kind of a cathartic, you know, in-service big ego. As people spend a lot of money to hang out with him while he runs around the stage and helps people cathart through the silliness of their lives and walk on coals, and everyone has had a great time. So there's a guy with a big ego that is making a shitload of money and seems to be, you know, in compassionate service to other humans. Whereas, you know, Steve Bannon might not be thought of in the same light. But the celebrities aside, as you begin to see the panorama of your acquisition strategies, and they're not just yours. I mean, it's clear they're everyone's. I mean, come on, you know, we're up to our eyeballs in acquisition strategy. And the remanufacture of the imagination of ourselves in space-time as meat puppets, vulnerable to an unloving, untrustworthy God. Yikes. The nature of acquisition strategies are beguiling. We return to them somewhat compulsively, involuntarily. Though we might be tired of them or worn out, or beleaguered or exhausted, you know, depressed or elated. They're like, they don't give a fuck. They don't quit.
You're pretty, exhaustive or... at least personally, I've tried like every effing angle. Like,
yeah,
I'll do everything. I'll do nothing. I'll try every single side of it. Like,
yeah, which is, I mean, you know, that's an archetypal, you know,
yeah,
adventure. You know, like Man of La Mancha. You know,
I don't recognize the reference.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know. It's a heroic journey to do and try everything, to be absolutely experimental and fearless to the extent that we can manage being fearless, to wiggle free. Not everyone, you know, it can say that about themselves. Most people are not all that creative and dedicated to wiggle free, are they? Most of us have become habituated, lovingly or otherwise, with the acquisition strategies that define the way that we move through the life, move through the day. Memory, regret, anticipation, manipulation, drama, security seeking, right? Getting our fair share of, in the ways that we do that.
Yeah, I was like sitting at work tonight thinking like, oh, like, I'll do the rest of this shit tomorrow. I really want to get like here. And I was like, man, by the time I get there, I'm going to be like tired of shit. Really wanted to go home. I'm like, fuck. Like.
Yeah. Yeah, you're fucked. Mm-hmm.
It's always waiting to get to the next thing, but
that's right.
It's never really what you think it's going to be.
Well, see, this is part of the banality of acquisition strategy.
Yeah.
Is always getting to the next thing. Yeah, it's kind of a rote way of, you know, getting through the life or getting through the day, being, in a sense, you know, task-oriented. It's like check, 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 sleep. Right? Back to check, 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 all throughout the day, sleep.
It's weird, though, how your perception works. Cause, like, you think, like, oh, like, I'm going to have to work, like, another 40,000 hours, but like it doesn't really phase you, you know, but you're just like, whatever's like right here, just trying to get to the next thing. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, you're not like, oh, I got another whatever 40 years worth of work or whatever. Like,
yes. Right. Yeah. I mean, what's crazy amongst so many things is that so-called actual experience is operating, we could say at a meta level that has absolutely nothing to do with our acquisition strategies or the assessments and assignments and accusations that we bring to the imagination of our lives as the owner, the arbiter, the dispatcher, the enjoyer, the driver, the passenger of our lives. This is all imagined. We would be wise to learn a new language, a representational language, which are the ones that we are accustomed to. It's not a neocortex affair. The new language is, well, it's what Amy Adams did in Arrival. She exposed herself fearlessly to the heptapods by pulling off her spacesuit with no concern for her safety. Because her heroic gesture was such that she was going to pass through this mutation without thought of or for herself. Her safety was absolutely secondary to wanting to get her hand on the glass to make contact with a mutative agent, which was the heroic gesture of, right, submitting herself to a cathartic mutation. That's what we have to do, too. And there's no heptapods around, so it's, you're going to have to, wing this shit. But you see, she exposed herself to an alien, possibly threatening, possibly cathartic intelligence had just shown up spontaneously on the scene all over the planet in various so-called cardinal points. And her own consciousness went through a mutation through her fearless exposure to a brand new language. Now, her capacity to travel into the future and bring back useful information to the present to avert a catastrophic encounter with the heptapods was, may I say, a metaphor for liberation. It's tough to depict what liberation should look like and feel like with space pals. But you can use, right, futuring. Practical futuring, dowsing the future to bring back information to the present to have a so-called useful or beneficial impact. It's crude, but it's not that terrible as a working metaphor for liberation. And it was through her exposure to the language, texturally, visually, right, academically, that it aroused a shift in her consciousness. And the heptapods, though they called it a weapon, just through their own naivete, meant it as, this is the gift we're bringing you fucking humans to see that time is not binding and that you can literally traverse past, present, and future in your consciousness without obstacle. And that might actually shift how you treat each other. Because we heptapods are going to need your help 2,000 years from now. So you better get your shit together. Because we're not going to be, we can't rely on you if you extinct yourselves out of, right, fear-based stupidity. Which is where, of course, we're all going. But who knows what the outcome of that might be. So the metaphor of liberation is no different than the way it was depicted in the film. A fearless, heroic gesture, exposure to a brand new language set that in many respects was uninterpretable, that played a role in the mutation of her consciousness, which fruit was, metaphorically speaking, liberated understanding. Okay, then. What is the language? What is the language for we plebeian acquisition saturated fuckers to use to expose ourselves to the possibility of, call it liberation, whatever that might be, and who knows? Now, most of the ways that, you know, liberation speak is taught, whether by Rupert Spira or whomever, has a lot to do with what I would consider rather banal metaphors, like mind, consciousness, duality, non-duality, thought, right? All of this shit that passes as, you know, purchasable spiritual lingo. Egad, it's a vomitorium. So let's say we were to dispose or dispense with all of that. So there is no metaphor for the present demonstration of liberation, save the simplicity of your availability. That's what you got. What you got is availability. What the fuck else is this than that? If you turn this into a story through a conditioned acquisition strategy that reinforces the myth of your being a creature, findable in space-time, full of heretical desires, and the frustration of same, then you remain an idiot. Though, hey, there's a bunch of nice idiots walking around. You can go to an art show, meet someone for a beer, have a cup of coffee, have a conversation about non-duality, get laid maybe if you're lucky and that's your thing. So, yeah, idiots are cool. No problem. But if one's interest is piqued, is desirous of whatever liberation might portend, well, then you have to be, or one would be wise to be, capable of exposing yourself to a brand new non-referential language that language is this. This is that language. This is the pictogram of the heptapod in squid ink. This is it. So present experience is the revelation and the catharsis and the fruition of liberation itself. It has always been. As if there has been an always, a has always, and that's even suspect. Availability is untarnished, untainted. It is no longer beleaguered by the habit of justifying or recreating oneself as a practical unit or creature in, right, the task-oriented consumption of living one's so-called life. That flatlines.
Yeah, so this time there was like no, you know, strange sensations or fireworks or anything, but it was like, and I'm sitting here thinking like, okay, you know, not a symptom, like not looking for any symptoms here. So I'm like, so what is it I'm looking for? Like thinking back to other like weird experiences I had. And yeah. I'm like, the thought hit me like, well, if I find anything, like every time that's going to be an effing symptom. So
yes,
this is it. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
Sweet. So this availability has no duration. It has no genesis. It didn't begin. It doesn't end. It has no duration. It's symptom full to the point of nausea, but it has no symptoms. The acquisition strategy, ceases. Though it needn't end. The habit to derive benefit, knowledge, wisdom, articulation from present experience keeps the self churning. That is the function of the acquisition strategy. Har, har, har. Its collapse is also absolutely present without effort, without an on-ramp, without clever assignment or vow of any kind. You see, the imagination of one's life is the outgassing. That is, filling or occupying the space of availability. But our attention is drawn to the acquisition strategy and its outgassing as definition of self. Okay, no biggie. But if we continue to use the habit of acquisition strategy, which is space-time and meat puppet, to look for symptoms or proof of one's liberation, you're going to come up empty-handed. Because the looking is already under the influence of the acquisition strategy.
Is it strange how that barrier gets drawn there? Because if you have like a cramp, you're like, oh, like my like leg hurts, it's my muscle. But then like if you like are sitting on the chair, you're like, oh, I feel this chair. But I mean, there's not really a difference.
No. This is a mutation, which is different than an education. It's a discontinuous shift or appreciation of the texture of present experience. Which turns out to be capable of releasing so-called one from the tempest of apparition. Even if we start using fancy terminology, whether Sanskrit or Aramaic or Hebrew or, you know, whatever, non-dualistic, even if you use fanciful language, you'll see how that conjures and connotes more sublime acquisition strategy. And we objectify, you know, incoming data, incoming information so quickly. And the objectification of information is another, call it outgassing of the acquisition strategy that, again, creates the suspicion of the sense of self. Because an object found kind of points to the finder of that object. Objects found is just another way of looking at the, you could call it the geometry of the acquisition strategy and assertion of the mirage of self. Availability, synonymous with so-called present experience, synonymous with the radiant revelation of liberation at hand, is what this is. And every encounter with it, whether hopefully conjured through a blasphemous conversation like this one, or going shopping for shoes, or getting to the church on time, or whatever you're doing or not doing, you know, you are one is, this is always at full saturation. This is always the radiant revelation of absolute liberation. But not liberation for someone from something, but just the intoxication of availability itself. Without utility, without interpretation. if it's merely philosophical, even though that can be kind of fun, it has, you know, marginal impact. But if it has, if it's truly a wormhole for your attention, for the texture of your experience to be released, you know, momentarily from time to time, occasionally, from the inertial myth of self, well, then it has legs. It can, it will disarm you. Because the joy of this irrationality, well, it has a transcendent potential, transcendent actualization, and getting the taste or a sniff of the transcendence of present experience, well, it will take you down. Because the myth of yourself can't hold a candle to it. The myth of oneself is just a shithouse of pride and fear and self-loathing. Whereas what this might actually be, the revelation of object-free liberation, well, that shit's going to fill you up. Restlessness is a symptom of evasion, though that evasion is not necessarily, you know, willfully done. Availability is, in the way that we're referring to it, is an antidote to evasion. Thank you. acquisition strategy, the mind bubbles up, bubbles forth, starts self-entertaining, creates context, content. Then it places itself in the midst of this imaginary context and imaginary content, and then one becomes consumed and inebriated with the movement of mind, the movement of association. And that is evasion. That's restlessness. The myth of oneself is evasion. But you don't want to suggest or create adversarial, right? Relationship or adversarial boundary conditions. A new vocabulary, a new language, non-referential language, the language of availability. It doesn't rely on objects, it doesn't create objects. It's objectless. And by virtue of being objectless, it also does not illumine subjectivity, which is the myth of the sense of oneself. Resting in availability is intimacy. But that intimacy is without object. It's free of the burden of subject. It's not under the influence of time or spatial coordinates or location. It's not proud of itself. It doesn't raise a flag and call it consciousness, or raise a flag and call it I am. We're exposing ourselves to a quality or texture of intelligence that is not, does not trigger and is not influenced by the referential prowess of the neocortex. And it needn't have a destination or an outcome or a utility, because the availability itself is the liberation. The availability itself is its own fruition. While many, you know, persons of sincere motivation and moral fortitude will busy themselves in self-improvement dramas. The aspirant that rests in availability is not so motivated. Because the myth of your life is, it doesn't take hold. Your appetites will come and go. You'll bathe and clothe and eliminate with, great sincerity. But the imagination, the myth and imagination of you being the recipient or driver of your life can and most likely will dissipate and no longer be a defining or driving force for how you move through a so-called day. The texture of availability, you could say, becomes the predominant relationship. That intelligence is, nourishing, sovereign. You could say it's the practical cleansing of codependency. See, codependency is a symptom of evasion, restlessness, vulnerability, right? At riskness, suffering between the two poles of enmeshment and abandonment. And hurts a lot too, of course. But resting in availability is a dawning of a transcendent intelligence. That heals, heals the myth of loneliness or aloneness. But that's not necessarily why to do it. That's probably not motivating enough. As the volume of this availability grows in you, as you, could we say we become a lot more lenient and, accepting or disinterested in the quirky shit that drives us? Because the quirky shit that drives us is, it has its own life, you could say. It has its own right to be. But you're no longer a product of that, either adversarially or addictively or self-celebratingly. Okay, everyone is a quirky, crazy, fucked up fool. Check. Get it. But that doesn't have to interfere with the dawning of a transcendent texture of intelligence. that's good for this evening?
Sure.
Yeah, I probably should get some sleep today anyway.
Yeah. Pizza, sleep. Then sleep.
No, I had to work real late last night, and then, like...
Thanks, folks.
Missed sleep the night
before. See you around.